From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made tonight at 7 p.m. when a new program debuts called Exploring the Territory: White People Look at Race and Racism. And in some ways, it's a twist on many of the discussions about race we tend to hear. For good reason, we often hear from academics, authors, professional analysts in this particular subject. Tonight, some of the people leading the discussion are white. They don't have formal racism training or anything like that. They simply care deeply about this community. And in their own words, they've put together, quote, a very compelling program to assist us white folks in freeing ourselves from the awkwardness we often encounter around the topic. Well said. They're my guests for the hour, and let me welcome Frank and April Starpoli. They're the facilitators of Exploring the Territory. And April, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Frank, nice to have you here as well.
Thank you, Evan.
Also in studio with me is Stephen Giroux, who is the director of the Upstate New York, or the Rochester chapter, of the National Coalition Building Institute. And this is where Stephen is more of an expert, at least in these kinds of dialogues. Because Stephen, tell us a little bit about what the organization is, the National Coalition Building Institute.
Sure, thanks. Thanks for having us, Evan.
Sure.
The National Coalition Building Institute is a nonprofit organization. We're a leadership development organization, and our goal is simply to end the mistreatment of any person or any group wherever it occurs. And we do this through a process of engagement. Blame, shame, guilt don't get us anywhere. They just seem to alienate us even more. We've been in the community for close to 30 years, working with schools on campuses, nonprofit organizations, giving people the skills and the confidence they need in order to be able to create a society that is more just.
You know, lately it has seemed so supercharged and polarized. Sometimes that's because the angriest voices are the loudest voices, and that doesn't always represent the so-called middle. But it does feel pretty polarized lately, and we've had some listeners say, you know, why did you have this person on? Or you're not going to change any minds when you do this. And I always say that my mind is always open to being changed about anything, and I really believe that, and I value that for this program and in my own life. And I believe that as polarized as things can feel, that minds can change. I would bet over the years you've seen a lot of tension, and have you seen it diffused with these kinds of dialogues?
Absolutely. My own case is an example of somebody who comes into a situation with a particular mindset, and through dialogue and openness and desire to hear what another person's experiences have been, that has been a great eye-opening for me. And part of the goals of our workshops and the trainings that we do is to leave the space that we're in with a bigger picture than when we began.
All right, well, if you want to attend tonight, they've got limited space, and a lot of the space is filled up, but I think they have a few spaces left for the program called Exploring the Territory, White People Look at Race and Racism. And Stephen, how would they do that?
I think the easiest thing would be to call my office, and the number is 224-7238.
Do it again.
224-7238.
And if you want to register, that's how you can do it for tonight's program. It starts at 7 o'clock. Where is it tonight, Stephen?
It's at the Starbridge offices, 1650 South Avenue.
Okay. So in Rochester. Piece of cake. If you are listening and you want to join the conversation about race this hour, you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. If you're watching on City 12 on Time Warner Cable in the city of Rochester, hello. And if you are listening online, and if you want to participate online, I'm at Evan Dawson on Twitter. And my producer for the program, producer is Megan Mack. It's M-Mack Media as well. So a couple ways that you can participate. But I want to start really as we kind of work our way through this discussion with Frank and April. You know, later this hour, we're going to hear from Reverend Myra Brown, who is an anti-racism trainer and has had some remarkable experience in this subject. But, you know, for now, hey, it's four white people sitting in a room talking about race. And a lot of people say, well, what good is that going to do us? But that part of the point is how we sort of clam up, or we get kind of feel awkward, et cetera. And April, why don't I start with you? You're a teacher by trade. Why did you want to put this kind of a program together?
I think it really came from Frank put the program together and invited me to attend. And while I was there, I mean, I'm attending because this is a subject that I'm passionate about. But while I was there, I realized some things that I was internalizing from my youth. And that's one of the exercises that this workshop asks us to do, is to think about our history and how we have been raised through the lens of race and racism. And I always thought of myself as being very enlightened on this subject. And having had that experience this late, you know, I'm 45 years old, I've always had a passion for speaking out about race and racism, and not realizing where that came from was sort of eye-opening for me. So to get involved with Frank and be there while other people do this and have this experience, I think that's what's sort of pressing me, because I think it's important for us to find out where we're internalizing. And just to give you a little background, when I was a little girl, I had an experience with some friends, and they were friends of mine that were Black. And we had an argument, as kids do. And I told my dad about it. And his reaction was not what I expected. I expected him to react the way I reacted, or the way he reacted when I fought with my sister. But he was angry and hateful. And I felt betrayed and angry back, that I shouldn't have told my dad that this happened. And I was confused. And I realized that throughout my life, I keep getting that same angry feeling whenever I'm presented with this topic. And at one point, I kind of walked away from discussions about it because I just got too angry. I didn't want to hear what people had to say. I didn't want to have to try to educate everyone on the subject. It was frustrating. And then I realized that by talking about it, I might be enlightening someone that could possibly have the power over my students to someday not give them a job, or give them a job, or someday not accept them into college, or accept them into college. And these conversations, I have to like settle my spirit a little bit before I have them, but I think they're necessary for everyone.
Okay. Frank, why don't you tell me why you wanted to put a program like this together?
Well, first of all, you can hear in April's response why I asked her to be a co-facilitator with me. She's so aware and such a generous spirit. For me, I would say I have been concerned for years. The concern is not new. I would say that I have felt compassion, I've felt concern, I've felt discouragement over the years about racial divide in this country. What was new for me in the last maybe year and a half is the recognition that my concern, if it ends at concern, is useless. My care is useless if it doesn't result in some way in being engaged in this subject. And if my guilt, Steve mentioned before, the idea of blame, shame, and guilt don't get us anywhere. Well, my concern, my compassion, my goodwill were there, but that doesn't amount to anything. And so I wanted to see what is my part in this? How do I fit into what is actually happening in society? I can claim some expertise, and that is in systems and how systems operate. So families, organizations, societies. And I know that if I am not engaged in some way in a solution, then in some way I'm part of the problem. So with that mindset, I started to just investigate and recognize the ways in which inadvertently I play into the racist divide that we have. And that I also recognized so many of us white folks, including the folks who are of goodwill and good intent, do play into that. And it became clear more and more, especially as I talked with some Black friends and Black mentors. When I mentioned the idea of talking with white people, they said, yes, yes, do that. In effect, they said, we're tired of it. You take over. You're supposed to be educating yourselves. You know, we've been trying that long enough. And, you know, without quite saying it, I think they mean you're pretty dense. And so, yeah, go do that, you know. And so that's become a mission for me.
Now, some of what Frank is saying, I think, is it can apply in many different ways. The question of just having a good sentiment, is that enough? You know, a lack of action. And that is a really powerful thought. I don't know, Megan Mack, producer, if we still have the Louis C.K. cut, one of my favorite cuts we have in the last year. Maybe you'll find it in the library if we've got it. He he had this monologue where he was poking fun at himself for the same issue, not on race, though. He was talking about how when he flies, he tends to fly first class because he's pretty wealthy now. And he often will see a soldier pass him on his way on the way back to coach. And he always thinks, I should give my first class seat to the soldier. But he never does. But he always feels good at just having had the thought. You know, he's very rewarding of himself for just the sentiment.
Exactly.
You know, and that's sort of what you're talking about here, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, very definitely. Mm-hmm.
And can we listen to it? I don't do a good Louis C.K. impersonation, so I think this is the cleaned up version without. Let's listen to Louis C.K.
Anyway, so I was on a plane for his first class, and a soldier gets on a plane. I see soldiers fly all the time because that's how they get to the war. You think they get to go in a cool green plane with a red light? Go, go, go! No, they just go to Delta, and they just wait in line to go to a war. And they always fly coach. I've never seen a soldier in first class in my life. And they're always nice. And every time that I see a soldier on a plane, I always think, you know what? I should give him my seat. It would be the right thing to do. It would be easy to do, and it would mean a lot to him. I could go up to him, hey, son. I get to call him son. Hey, son, go ahead and take my seat. And I should trade with him. I never have. Let me make that clear. I've never done it once. I've had so many opportunities. I never even really seriously came close. And here's the worst part. I still just enjoyed the fantasy for myself to enjoy. I was actually proud of myself for having thought of it. I was proud. Oh, I am such a sweet man. That is so nice of me to think of doing that and then totally never do it.
That's Louis C.K.
Perfect.
Yes, Frank?
Perfect.
Yeah. That's the message. That's the message. And that applies to so many things in our lives. It is, and maybe, if I could take it a step further here, maybe there's a risk in a lot of people who would self-identify as progressive. I think one of the risks is, you know, feeling enlightened because of a mentality that you have if it's not accompanying any action.
Exactly.
Yeah. But that's hard.
I'd like to give a quote here from this is Nicholas Kristof, who is a well-known New York Times writer. Mm-hmm. He has done a lot of research on the issue and of race, and he was looking at systems and how much injustice is embedded in the system, and also looking at society in general. This is what he said after all that research. Research in the last couple of decades suggests that the problem is not so much overt racists, a small number of twisted white supremacists. Rather, the larger problem is a broad swath of people who consider themselves enlightened, who intellectually believe in racial equality, who deplore discrimination, yet who harbor unconscious attitudes and act in ways that result in discriminatory policies and behavior.
So that's the same message, right?
Well, mm-hmm. It indicts me, for sure.
Okay, but what do you mean then, Frank? Let's get specific then. Because you said as you thought about your own life and
yes.
you compared your own thoughts and mm-hmm. feelings and mm-hmm. beliefs mm-hmm. to the actions, and you said you started to feel as if you were helping perpetuate some of the racial divide. How?
Well, I do. To the extent that I wouldn't speak out when I see something, to the extent that I'm reluctant to raise a conversation, to the extent that I would vote for candidates who have questionable beliefs or views on racial issues, to the extent that I don't contact those candidates and let them know what my views are. In that sense, I would say I was, and this is not out of guilt, it's just recognition that by not acting, I am complicit in why the system continues. And even though I can sit there puzzled and say, gee, this is awful, and why doesn't it change, if I'm not part of the change, I'm part of why it continues.
Okay. What do you think, April?
I just think about that it brought, in my mind, a memory of when I first started teaching, and I was actually teaching in the city of Rochester. And I had a few students that I needed to call home about. And being a new teacher, I was asking other teachers, like, how do I approach, you know, having to call a parent and say your child is not passing is difficult, and I don't want to give parents bad news, so I was apprehensive about it. And I had a teacher say to me, well, I don't call parents because they just think I'm racist. And immediately I thought, well, isn't that racist of you to not call parents because they think you're racist? And those are the little things. Like, I had to say something to her, like, well, that's racist, you know, and she hadn't thought of it. She simply hadn't thought that was racist. So those little instances that I have the opportunity to just maybe mention that,
raise consciousness.
Yes, a little bit, you know, at least. Those are the kinds of experiences that I've seen many, many times, or been privy to over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the issue of remaining silent, let's get our first phone call. This is Jenna in Pittsford. Go ahead, Jenna.
You and I have talked many times, Evan, about my family, and when your speaker just talked about remaining silent, it really hit a chord for me because I'm very active on social media, as you know. And I've remained largely silent about my family, and I've often joked that we look like a Benetton ad. My brother, who is a retired Army major, is married to a woman from the Philippines, and because of post 9/11 regulations, she's not allowed to bring her daughters into our country. So they remain in the Philippines, where my brother built a home. But my sister-in-law is married to the son of a former Somali diplomat. So he is African-American, Somali, and Muslim. And so my family is Muslim, and my nieces and nephews are Muslim. And we talked to my sister-in-law the other day, and they are very scared because his mom and sisters and brothers, and they're very touched by all the rhetoric that is going on and the hatred. And I have remained largely silent on social media because of what's happening. And my husband and I have been attacked because of where we live in Pittsburgh, and it's white and it's rich, and we live in a gated community, which is such nonsense. But I did post an essay from a Chicago lawyer the other day about being Muslim and what it means in America, because I wanted to speak out, but I didn't want my sister-in-law to take any blowback or be attacked, or my brother-in-law to receive any negative feedback for what he does publicly, because I think I want them to be protected in a large way. And my brother, who was in the military, he served with the major at Fort Hood, who committed that horrible atrocity. But it's scary. It is a scary time.
So you find yourself having to decide, do I say something, or is it better to stay silent because I'm worried about the impact on family?
Exactly. And I at the same time, for my kids, who are white, middle-class Americans, but have multiracial friends, and you know that my son is participates in a gay alliance group in Pittsburgh, when he's straight, he's in that group, saying to him, you need to speak up for your friends and you need to defend your friends, and I absolutely want you to speak out proudly. And I want you to know what you need to say, and we practice this at the dinner table and we talk about it openly, but to be careful.
Yeah.
And that to me is sad and scary, to feel like we're practicing our First Amendment rights. That's where I feel like people like Donald Trump are making me afraid. That I don't think is right or correct as a presidential candidate. Mm.
Thank you, Jenna.
I'll hang up.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. And I can't even imagine the feeling of not knowing if you can say something because you don't know if your own voice is going to put family members in any kind of peril. And I'm hoping that a lot of the fear is more imagined than real. Or fear is very real, but I'm hoping that it will subside right now. But boy, that phone call, that's really tough to hear. Stephen, what do you think?
Well, if it's hard for us, just think what it's like for people targeted by racism,
yeah,
who are people of color, who experience indignities, insults, being dismissed, not being heard when other people around the table might be making the same comment and they get reinforced. They are really looking for us because we are the people who have the capacity and the power and the privilege, and we're part of a dominant group to help change those kinds of systems. So it's very easy for them to be discouraged by the lack of awareness and our inability to speak up or our fear of speaking up. And I simply encourage people to go be aware of the fear and speak up, because being silent only, as Frank says, perpetuates systems of injustice.
Well, it's important, I think, to step back also and ask Frank if you want to just mention it all for those who are coming out tonight for the event. If you're just joining us, we're talking about this event tonight at 7 p.m. in Rochester called Exploring the Territory, White People Look at Race and Racism. Frank Starpoli had the idea for this not as someone who is an expert in anti-racism or someone with that kind of training, but just as someone with concern for the community. And so Frank is one of the facilitators of this event tonight. What are some of the things that you will talk about? I mean, you've given us a sense for it, but what are some of the points that you'll be talking about tonight?
Well, there are two major pieces to the workshop. I would say the first is an exploration of our history. What are the messages I heard growing up? What were my circumstances as I grew up? In my case, for example, I didn't go to school with black children. I didn't go to school with black people in high school, in college, in graduate school. In my first three jobs, I had very little contact with black people along the way. And at the same time, in being raised in my family, I heard all kinds of messages about black people, most of which were quite negative. And so I absorbed those, not intentionally, but they are embedded there. And I think that would be true for a majority of white people. And so even though later on I came to have a compassion, as I said before, and empathy, those messages are still in me. So we ask people to take a look back at their own history and understand what some of those messages might be. And the second piece is asking us as white people to take a look at the advantages that we do have because we are white and whatever disadvantages we think we have because we are white. And so to become more conscious, more reflective of what those advantages are. Most of us as white people don't are not aware of those advantages because we don't have to be. And so, for example, I'm thinking about a man who lives in Brighton, a black man who is a professional. And before he goes out on an errand or goes shopping, whatever, he makes sure that he's shaven and is wearing good clothes. And the reason that he does that is that he's had too many instances where he will walk into some place, people will look at him as if to say, well, what are you doing here? Or to be followed. Or when you try to give somebody a check to pay for something, they reach for the bad checklist. This is in Brighton. This is one of the liberal bastions among Rochester and Monroe County suburbs. So I don't even think about that. If I go out, I can go out unshaven with crummy jeans and paint on my T-shirt, whatever. So that's one minor example of the advantages that we have. So the workshop invites us to take a look at what those advantages are, just for a deeper understanding.
Yeah, I think there's a confirmation bias that a lot of us have, which is says, to the extent that we're successful, we don't want to chalk it up to anything other than our own hard work. and that's, let nobody listening to this program think that invalidates hard work.
Absolutely.
That invalidates the effort and the remarkable work ethic that many people do have. I'm simply saying, no one can ever put a formula, a number. Your success in life, again, however you want to measure it, whether it's your income, your family, the house you live in, the whatever it is. And some people will accuse me of choosing superficial measures right there, but that's another conversation. The bottom line is no one's going to have a formula for where the success exactly comes from. But if you are white, it's easy to think that race is zero, and it's probably not zero. Fair?
Not even close. Right?
Okay. Well.
Yeah. And, you know, part of it for me is that I determined to do some research on this because I really wanted to find out what is the story about discrimination. Does it really exist to the extent I think it does, or is it just in people's minds? And I can tell you after doing a lot of research that every major system that we have in this country is rigged. And that's the education system, the employment system, the healthcare system, the housing system, certainly the justice system, the transportation. Every system, and this is not just an opinion, it's factual data that show these systems are fraught with injustice. And us as white folks, for the most part, don't see it, don't recognize it, because we're not on the receiving end.
Let me grab one more phone call before a short break, and then in our second half hour, I'm going to bring in Reverend Myra Brown. But first, let me bring in Norma in Rochester. Go ahead, Norma.
Yes, hi, Evan. Evan, you and I know each other very well.
I thought it was you.
Coworker.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm listening to this, and I think this is fantastic, and so I applaud the people who are putting this meeting on tonight, this session. You know, the thing that I have found after living in Rochester my entire life, growing up in a mixed-race family, the one thing I have discovered is I've met many wonderful white people who are kind-hearted and good-hearted, but do not consider themselves as harboring any racial or any racist thoughts, because their whole world has been around people who look like them. So they're not in contact, and as the gentleman just said, you know, he grew up with, you know, it all throughout his education with no one of color. So, you know, sometimes people will think, well, I'm not racist. I don't have racist thoughts, you know. But then if you look at their lives are completely, everyone in their world is white. And you know what? In some cases, it's because they never had the chance to meet anyone new, or they just never bothered because, well, why should I, you know? And so I find that sometimes there's that kind of, I won't say it's racism, but it's almost a, like living with blinders on, you know what I mean? Where you don't even try to seek out anyone of another race to hear their viewpoint because you've never had to. So why would you need to? And I'm not racist. I don't have racist thoughts, or I don't think about people that way. And it's, again, it kind of speaks back to the whole, you know, Louis C.K. joke about, I have good thoughts, so therefore I am good, you know. So I wonder if maybe that will come up tonight, if people will say, well, my whole world is white. How do I possibly then expand on my life and expand my horizon and my viewpoint if everyone around me thinks the same way?
Yes, this is,
and
like,
I've never been exposed to anyone.
This is such a good point back to that Louis C.K. thing, Norma, because one of the logical extensions of that is, well, I want to feel like I care about all cultures, all people, that I'm not the kind of person who's only going to surround myself with people who are just like me. But most of us do. I probably do. If I'm going to sit down and analyze it myself, we all probably can do better with that. We feel like I'm a good person. I would definitely associate with people of all creeds and religions and race and ethnicity and background. But most of the time, we really don't. And I think that's the consequence, don't you, Norma? When you go through life and you very rarely see somebody who's not a lot like you, it's easy to feel like the other is the other. You know, someone who's not like your category is an other.
Oh, absolutely. And that's only natural. So I don't, you know, and that's why, like, you know, many times, Evan, I've been the only other in the room. Like, I've been, you know, the brownest person in the room, and I'm not even brown. If you look at me, you know, my sister has felt that more acutely, being darker skinned, Hispanic, but also African American and white mixed. And so what happens is you are always the other, right? And so you're the, but then, you know, you sometimes get people who will say to you, I'm not racist. They may, I'm friends with you, they say. And I always laugh. I always go, oh, well, if that's your, you know, your threshold for not being racist, you know, you need to work on that. Because, I am often the only other. And people will say, you know, again, I'm not racist, I'm friends with you. And I have a pretty good sense of humor about this stuff, as you well know. But I think it's incumbent upon all of us. And I'd love to hear the Reverend's comments later on, because if you seek out the other, right, and intentionally, without being fake, and I don't want people to feel like, you know, you're putting on air, like, well, I'm going to go make friends with a black person today, or someone of color, or a person of a different religion or faith. No, I don't want it to be like that. It should be more organic and
yes.
more natural. But you're right, Evan. It's very easy to kind of go through your daily life. You work with the same people every day. You see the same neighbors every day. And you don't think about it, you know. But if you try, it's amazing how you see the humanity in other people. And so it's a challenge for everyone, really. And especially in these days, Evan, like you said, it's not even just about race. It's about faith and how we look at other people of other faiths. And so I know I try to do that. I'm conscious of it. You know, I wish I didn't have to think about it, though. I wish it could just be more, like I said, a little more organic.
Yeah.
But it's a lesson for everybody.
Yes, absolutely. I love you, my friend. Thank you for calling.
Always. No problem.
That's Norma calling the program with some great thoughts. And I will just add to Norma's point before I kick it over to April. I was thinking recently the way we talk about Muslims in this country, and there is a vibrant local Islamic community. I have been inside the Islamic Center once, and whenever we want to talk about Islamic issues, we have folks on the program. There's plenty of people in the Islamic community, but I don't see them very often outside of this program. Mm-hmm. So lately I've taken to all these wonderful people coming in from the local Islamic community. I've been stalking them on Facebook. I friend them on Facebook. I said, let me buy you coffee. Some of them don't drink coffee. I say, all right, let me buy you whatever you want. And that maybe that's not as organic as Norma's talking about, but that's another experience that I'm not someone who's had a lot of. And that I want to do better with. So, but I appreciate exactly the sentiment there. April?
Well, there's a few things that this caller mentioned that piqued my interest. One of them was the notion of thinking that when you're surrounded by a homogeneous group of people, and no, even if people aren't making racist comments, the larger implication is that if you don't hear it, you think it doesn't exist. And if you're only with people who aren't having those discussions, you think it doesn't exist. And then we hear, I've heard jokes like, racism, is that still happening? You know, like, really, if you're in a group of people who aren't having the discussion, and I think that's what we're doing tonight, is just having the discussion, yes, it still exists. And by not talking about it, it's not going away. But also, it's funny that she said that, because I noticed I left Rochester for 10 years, and where I went was very diverse. I was just in Atlanta, Georgia, but it's an incredibly diverse city. And I just moved back recently, and I've noticed more and more that I'm surrounded by more white people. And I think when you have the benefits of being in a diverse setting and it's taken away from you, or you're not there anymore, you notice it more. Mm. And I feel like I miss it. It hurts a little bit. So I think that is also beautiful when people go out and just place themselves in a setting that is diverse and realize how amazing that experience is, that when you don't have that experience anymore, you miss it.
So April, you're kind of saying, look, organically, if you can do it the way Norma's describing, that's great, but however we do it, we've got to kind of break away a little bit.
Yeah, you do. You have to do it. Yeah.
It's interesting, too. I had a conversation just recently with a very senior university official locally, and he was telling me that I was asking him about affirmative action. I wanted to learn how it works in colleges and so on. He was telling me that nowadays affirmative action has been largely eviscerated by the Supreme Court gradually over time. Ever since it was instituted, it's been cut back and cut back in terms of the teeth that it has. But what he was saying is that nowadays a lot of colleges and universities are pursuing diversity not because they have to, but because they're beginning to recognize there really is a tremendous benefit to preparing people to live in a more integrated world. And, to your point, it's to get away from that homogenous group mm-hmm. all the time. And so universities are doing it more and more because they're seeing there's a benefit, not just because somebody said you should.
All right, I'm way late for a break, but let me ask. That's okay. See, look what you've done. You're going to have a great night tonight of conversation because there's so much to talk about here. Stephen Giroux is the director of the Rochester chapter of the National Coalition Building Institute, and they are essentially hosting that event tonight. The event is called Exploring the Territory, White People Look at Race and Racism, tonight at 7 o'clock, and there's still a little bit of room left to register. If you want to do that, Stephen, they call?
Yep, the number is 224-7238.
You always got to do it twice.
224-7238. And if it's possible to appreciate the comment that Norma made for emphasis, is we have many myths in American society, U.S. society today. One of them is that it's the myth of meritocracy, that we all start out on the same footing and all it takes is hard work and you can have the ideal life. There's also this myth that there are good white people who are not racist, and then there are those others who are racist. And the way our culture is set up is that we have been enculturated with power, privilege, and dominance in ways that we're not even aware of. And until we begin to uncover the mask, this illusion that everything is good to go, that then we remain isolated and separated and segregated from each other. And nobody wins when that happens.
All right, short break and much more your phone calls. We are loaded up with phone calls as well. Coming up next on Connections. Yeah. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections, first hour. Who should you be tipping extra this time of year? Maybe your mailman, mail carrier, a UPS driver. What about a barista? What about the person who cuts your hair? It's the etiquette of holiday tipping, first hour. Then, second hour, why are there so many conflicting statistics on how many mass shootings we've had? We will break down what the numbers mean. Talk to you then.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Nazareth College Art Center, presenting Cirque-tacular Entertainment's holiday show Snokus Pocus, a family show where Cirque meets ballet in a whimsical world, Saturday, December 19th at 7 p.m. Details at artcenter.naz.edu.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You just heard Stephen Giroux, who is with the Upstate New York chapter of the National Coalition Building Institute. The program tonight was Frank Starpoli's idea. He's the facilitator of Exploring the Territory, and he roped in April Starpoli. Well, he wants to credit both of them. That's it's just Frank's way there. And so they're both here facilitating this event tonight. I want to bring in Reverend Myra Brown on the line with us. Reverend is with Spiritus Christi Church, and the last time Reverend and I talked, Myra, we were talking about anti-racism training after the whole situation kind of blew up in Henrietta with the supervisor there. And that was, to me, one of the most powerful conversations of the entire year. So I'm glad to have you back. How are you?
I'm great.
Well,
good to be back with you, Evan.
Well, I just wanted to – the reason I wanted to call you and ask you to kind of join the program briefly is just to share your thoughts about the goals that Frank and April have laid out here in saying that – you know, we don't have expertise in anti-racism training, et cetera. They love this community. They care. There's a lot of people like them who are white who feel like, well, is it my position to say something, to lead a public event, to lead a discussion? But I think, as Frank said, you know, he felt like we've got to do this. We've got to talk more forcefully. We've got to act and not just talk. What do you make of some of what you've heard?
Yeah, I actually am very excited that they're doing this workshop. I think the work of undoing racism is all of our work. It's not just the work of people of color. Absolutely, I think white people have to be willing to step up and not worry about whether or not they're experts or not. I think any time that we have developed and learned some insight about racism and how it's working in the world and how it's damaging our humanity and how it's stripping us of who we were designed to be, any time that a white person or person of color is willing to step up and go back to their communities and open up conversation about that and say, we need to talk, right, that there are things that are happening among us in our communities, in our world that we're connected to and part of, that we need to actually put some action towards to reverse that and to dismantle that and to undo it, I think that's an excellent moment in history when that starts to happen. So I don't think that you have to be experts. I think you have to be willing to share what you've learned. And I'm excited about the fact that Frank and April are stepping up and saying, you know what, I've learned some things about racism, how I may have participated in it, how a history that I may have come to with some denial and some minimization, but I've been able to cross that divide. And I want to be able to help other white people to start that same journey. I think that's exactly what needs to happen in Rochester, and it's the only way that we're going to start to really do anything significant about structural and institutional racism and individual racism.
Well, let me ask Myra to stay on the line with us. We've got our panelists in studio, and I think what will be helpful is to go to a caller who wants to push back a little bit. And one of our somewhat regular callers is Tim in Pittsford, who is a thoughtful guy. He's a father, I think we talked earlier in this program about how some people inevitably feel like this conversation invalidates hard work and makes people feel bad about who they are. And it's not the goal, but it does happen. And I think this will be instructive to bring Tim in. So go ahead, Tim.
How did I know you were going to go to me first? That's great. I have to be the voice of reason sometimes here, just for the everyday man. I work at a job, half the department is white, the other half, like Norma said, is other, Puerto Rican, black. We have it's just that everyone, it's like a family there, and we all get along great. That being said, I'm the normal person. I go to work at 7 in the morning. I may get back at 5. I may get back at 7. I may not get back even that day. So this theory that Norma's throwing out there of you have to go seek this out and it's almost racist that you're not going to seek other people out. My wife and I on weekends will take our 3 kids, time willing, to so many diverse things, whether it's downtown, out in the suburbs, wherever. It doesn't matter to us what kind of function is. I mean, we've literally been to the Puerto Rican festival for lunch on a Saturday, and we were literally the only white people there and didn't think anything of it. But this whole seeking this out, and we're kind of racist for not seeking other people out. I don't have to. Where is the time coming from? I've got 3 little kids at home, a wife, and a normal job. I don't know what I'm supposed to do now. And I'm not saying I did or didn't get my job because I'm white. It's a very diverse workplace. But I mean, how many times do we have to talk about this where I have to feel worse or have to take another step to make up for all the other white people that I'm associated with? Yeah, we live in Pittsburgh. Yeah, it's 90-something% white. Is that my fault? We moved there because we're going to send the kids to one of the best school districts in the country. Now I have to feel bad for all this?
No, and so first of all, Tim, I hope you stay on the line. And I think a lot of what Tim is saying is represented by how a lot of people feel. So what I want to do is go around the table before we get to Reverend Brown. Frank, you're leading, you're facilitating the program tonight. Where do you start? Go ahead.
Where do I start? Tim, first of all, I understand what you're saying. And I believe a lot of white people see as you do. And I don't think it's so much you're wrong. I just think there's a perspective here that I'm coming to see more and more. And that is that I have some advantages in my life that other people do not have. The fact that you can live in Pittsburgh is important, I think. There are a lot of people who would love to own a home in Pittsburgh who can't. And that's because there are exclusions built into the housing system. And so it's subtle stuff. It's not. And I also want to say it does not do any good to inflict guilt on white folks. I don't think, certainly that's not what April and I are looking to do in this workshop. It's simply to raise our consciousness and raise our awareness of when we might speak up, when you might talk with some of your Pittsburgh neighbors, the conversations you might actually have at the workplace. You're fortunate you have a diverse workplace. Can you have conversations there about it? Wouldn't that be fascinating? Just to check out people's perceptions. There's such a fear, though, on the part of most of us as white people about starting those conversations. There's a term that's come into existence recently called white fragility. We're so afraid that we're going to say the wrong thing, that we're going to slip, that we're going to be called racist, that we're going to be considered one of those people. But what I would encourage you to do is just keep doing what you're doing and then talk with people about it.
April, go ahead. But before Tim responds, go ahead, April.
Well, I was actually just thinking some of the same thoughts. I don't know that it's necessary at this point for him to go seek out a diverse population of people because
this
for
may
him,
be a case where this is not about
organically.
Tim. Yeah, this is not. Yeah, this is.
It is.
Right.
I mean, he has a workplace that's diverse. Fantastic. awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know.
Yeah, let's say it was just some other guy who happened to work in an environment that was almost 90-something percent white and had the same job as me and wasn't seeking out anyone to try and be diverse, I'm supposed to say that, you know, he's not racist. I guess I am in some way, shape, or form, according to you guys, but let's just say he worked in a place where there wasn't that diversity. I mean, how many things in the world am I supposed to juggle now? I could feel, by the way, it's the subtle things. When you subtly say, it's nice that you can live in Pittsburgh, but I know where you're going with that. And I've called Evan plenty of times on how we're struggling to live in Pittsburgh. But it's just, you got to be realistic. I want the same thing for my family as a black person would want for their family, and I hope they get it. I may not be right next to them, cheering them on while they do get it. That's just, sometimes it just is how it is, and maybe it'll change in the future. But I am sick of feeling guilty all the time. And again, it is just a subtle thing.
All right. Thank you, Tim. I just want to follow what Tim's saying there. You know, I'm reading a story right now. This just came down today. You know, for people who think, we're done with this, we've talked about this, it's over, this is today. This is from 20 minutes ago. The headline, Justice Antonin Scalia says black students don't need affirmative action because they benefit from a slower track. During oral arguments on a case that may eliminate race-conscious affirmative action, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia said that, quote, most of the black scientists in this country do not come from the most advanced schools. He added that black students do better in a slower track.
Wow.
Scalia also said students of color are being, quote, pushed into schools that are too advanced for them due to race-conscious affirmative action policies. So that's today. Unfortunately, that's why we're going to keep talking about things like race, but in Tim's case, I don't know that all of what we're saying or what the panelists are saying apply to him specifically. Reverend Brown, how would you respond to someone like Tim, who I think has very good intentions in his heart, but is made to feel guilty, he says, and doesn't want to feel guilty?
Yeah, so I think this feeling of guilt as a white person is part of what gets in the way. I would encourage Tim to do some work to step over that, because I don't think it's helpful. Like, it's a little painful for me to hear in his statement the sense of burden that he feels, and even thinking about having to go deeper in diversity is sad for me. The sense of the necessity of it, of having to spend any more effort, is sad to me, because that, on some level, and this may be very unconscious, on some level it just says that there's a place where diversity doesn't hold as much value for him, because the things that we value deeply, we don't carry them around feeling burdened by them. We don't walk around feeling like this is too much work to do. Because why? Because we value it. We think that it's really important, and we can really sense that it's going to add to our life, right? And diversity really does do that. It's a very different thing for me to go to, you know, a show that the Islamic Center is putting on, than to actually seek out one of the women at the Islamic Center and say, I really don't have any Muslim friends, and I would like to start a relationship with you. I'd like to be your friend, right? And to actually put in some effort and realize that my life is actually going to be better and enhanced and enriched, right, by having that deeper relationship, because it's not just going to be kind of going in and going out based on the privilege that I have, but it's actually going to be a substantive relationship that's going to teach me something, that's going to really help me, right, when I go into situations where people are saying racist things and they're saying discriminatory things about the Islamic or the Muslim community. I actually have a body of knowledge that I can actually talk to people about. I have some experience that I can help them see things a little differently and kind of break out of this my perspective is the perspective trap that most of us fall into. So I guess I would say that I think we have to make time for these kinds of things. I think we make time for all kinds of stuff in our lives
as busy as we are. I don't think there's anybody more busy than I am.
All right, well, we got down to our last 90 seconds. Frank Starpoli, go ahead.
Very quickly, I just want to say that there are many opportunities locally to take the time to learn about racism and so on. The YWCA under Gene Carroll has been educating people for years. McClurg Vivian, Steve Jaros at National Coalition Building Institute. Myra Brown happens to be one who is, I consider, a mentor personally. So there are opportunities to educate yourself and learn, as we're trying to do, I think.
And so we've done our last minute here. One of our listeners on Twitter wanted to know, Stephen, is this only for white people to attend tonight? Frank?
I would say our focus is white people at this point, and there are reasons for that, and I've spoken with black friends and mentors who say that's good.
Okay, so but again, this is one of many events in our community that brings up race, and the aim tonight is specifically on the discomfort that whites sometimes feel in talking about their own background, about race in general. Stephen, down to our last 25 seconds, what do you want to leave the audience with here? Go ahead.
I'd like to appreciate and build on something that Tim said, and that was we all want the same things for our children. If we notice that there are disparities, then we can ask ourselves, what do I need to do to become more knowledgeable and informed so that I can truly help to create a more equitable society for everybody, children.
Thank you, Stephen, for taking the time to come in. It's great to have you here. Thank you. April Starpoli, thank you, April.
Thank you.
Frank, thank you.
Thank you.
You've started a conversation. And Reverend Brown, Myra, it's always great to talk to you, and I hope we've got more time soon to continue this conversation.
Thank you, Evan.
Listeners, go check out what Justice Scalia said this afternoon. Go read it. You know, this conversation is not ending anytime soon. That's the state of it. But we seek to continue to have it productively and constructively on this program. No matter who you are or how you feel, you're always welcome to join the conversation here. Thanks for listening to Member Supported Public Radio. Our engineer is Valerie Labanca, and the producer of Connections is Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson.